Hello and welcome to Byzantium and the Crusades. My name is Nick Holmes, and in the next few episodes we're going to look at how after the Second Crusade, the Crusader Kingdom started to falter just as the power of Islam started to get stronger. In this episode we're going to look at life in the Crusader Kingdoms, or Outremer as they were called, meaning overseas in French, and we'll find that the Crusaders never really established themselves in sufficient strength to be a viable long-term power in the region. As before, I'll read extracts from my abridged version of Sir Stephen Runciman's classic History of the Crusades. Hope you enjoy it. The failure of the Second Crusade marked a turning point in the story of Outremer. The fall of Edessa completed the first stage in the renaissance of Islam, and the gains of Islam were confirmed by the pitiful collapse of the great expedition that was to have restored Frankish supremacy. Among the chief reasons for this failure had been the difference in habits and outlook between the Franks resident in the east and their cousins from the west. It was a shock for the Crusaders to discover in Palestine a society whose members had in the course of a generation altered their way of life. They spoke a French dialect, they were faithful adherents of the Latin Church, and their government followed the customs that we call feudal. But these superficial likenesses only made the divergences more puzzling to the newcomers. Had the colonists been more numerous, they might have been able to keep up their Occidental ways, but they were a tiny minority in a land whose climate and mode of life was strange to them. Actual numbers can only be conjectural, but it seems that at no time were there as many as 1,000 barons and knights permanently resident in the Kingdom of Jerusalem. Their non-combatant relatives, women and old men, cannot have numbered much more than 1,000. Many children were born, but few survived. That is to say, apart from the clergy, who numbered a few hundred, and the knights of the military orders, there can only have been from 2,000 to 3,000 adult members of the Frankish upper classes. The combined population of the knightly classes in the Principality of Antioch and the counties of Tripoli and Edessa was probably about the same. These classes remained, on the whole, racially pure. In Edessa and Antioch, there was some intermarriage with the local Greek and Armenian aristocracy. For example, both Baldwin I and Baldwin II had, when counts of Edessa, married Armenian wives of the Orthodox persuasion, and we are told that some of their nobles followed their example. The class of the so-called sergeants was more numerous. The sergeants were, in origin, the fully armed infantry of Frankish stock, who settled on the lord's fiefs. As they had no pride of birth to maintain, they married with the native Christians, and by 1150 they were beginning to form a class of so-called poulains, already merging with the native Christians. By 1180 the number of sergeants was estimated at little more than 5,000, but we cannot tell what proportion remained of pure Frankish blood. Except in the larger towns, the settlers were almost all of French origin, and the language spoken in the Kingdom of Jerusalem and the Principality of Antioch was the langue d'oeil, familiar to the northern French and the Normans. In the county of Tripoli, with its Toulousain background, the langue d'oc was probably employed at first. The German pilgrim John of Würzburg, who visited Jerusalem in about 1175, was vexed to find that the Germans played no part in Frankish society, although, as he claimed, Godfrey and Baldwin I had been of German origin. He was delighted when at last he found a religious establishment staffed exclusively by Germans. The towns contained considerable Italian colonies. The Venetians and the Genoese each possessed streets in Jerusalem itself. There were Genoese establishments guaranteed by treaty in Jaffa, Acre, Caesarea, Arsuf, Tyre, Beirut, Tripoli, Jabal, Latakia, Saint Simeon, and Antioch, and Venetian establishments in the larger of these towns. The Pisans had colonies in Tyre, Acre, Tripoli, Botrun, Latakia, and Antioch, the Amalfitans in Acre and Latakia. These were all self-governing communes whose citizens spoke Italian and did not mingle socially with their neighbours. Akin to them were the establishments owned by Marseille in Acre, Jaffa, Tyre and Jabal, and by Barcelona in Tyre. Except in Acre, these merchant colonies numbered none of them more than a few hundred persons. The vast majority of the population of Outremer was composed of native Christians whose lineage went back centuries to the days before the advent of Islam, when these lands were part of the Christian, Roman and Byzantine empires. In the Kingdom of Jerusalem, these were of mixed origin, most Arab-speaking and carelessly known as Christian Arabs, almost all members of the Orthodox Church. In the county of Tripoli, some of the inhabitants were members of the monothelite sect called the Maronites. Further north, the indigenous inhabitants were mostly monophysites of the Jacobite Church, but there were very large colonies of Armenians. Almost all of the separated Armenian Church, and in Antioch, Latakia and Cilicia, considerable groups of Greek-speaking Orthodox Christians. In addition, there were in the Holy Land religious colonies of every Christian denomination. The monasteries were mainly Orthodox and Greek-speaking, but there were also Orthodox Georgian establishments, and especially in Jerusalem itself, colonies of monophysites, both Egyptian and Ethiopian, Copts and Syrian Jacobites, and a few Latin groups who had settled there before the Crusades. Many Muslim communities had emigrated when the Christian kingdom was set up, but there were still Muslim villages round Nablus, and the population of many districts that were conquered later by the Franks remained Muslim. In northern Galilee, along the road from Banias to Acre, the peasants were almost exclusively Muslim. Further north, in the Bukaya, the Nazari Mountains and the Orontes Valley, there were heretical Muslim sects acknowledging Frankish rule. These various communities formed the basis of the Frankish states, and their new masters did little to disturb them. Where natives could prove their title to lands, they were allowed to keep them. But in Palestine and Tripoli, with the exception of estates owned by the native churches, the landowners had almost all been Muslims who had emigrated as a result of the Frankish conquest, leaving large territories in which the new rulers could install their compatriot vassals. It seems that there were no free villages left, such as had existed in earlier Byzantine times. Each village community was tied to the land and paid a portion of its produce to the Lord. Though there was little change in the lives of these peasants, the Kingdom of Jerusalem was superficially reorganized according to the patterns of fiefs that we call feudal. The royal domain consisted of the three cities of Jerusalem, Acre and Nablus, and later the frontier town of Daron and the territory around them. It had occupied a larger proportion of the kingdom, but the first kings, and especially Queen Melisande, were lavish in the gifts of land that they made to friends and to the church and the religious orders. Further portions might be temporarily alienated as dowers for widowed queens. The four chief fiefs of the kingdom were the county of Jaffa, usually reserved for a cadet of the royal house, the principality of Galilee, which owed its grandiose title to Tancred's ambition, the seigneury of Sidon and the seigneury of Outrejordan. The holders of these fiefs seem to have had their own high officers in imitation of the kings. So also did the Lord of Caesarea, whose fief was almost as important, though it ranked with the 12 secondary fiefs. After Baldwin II's reign, tenure was based on hereditary right. Females succeeded in default of the direct male line. A tenant could only be evicted by a decision of the High Court after some gross misdemeanour. But he owed the king, or his superior lord, a fixed number of soldiers whenever it was required of him, and it seems that there was no time limit to their service. The Count of Jaffa, the Lord of Sidon, and the Prince of Galilee owed 100 fully armed knights, and the Lord of Outrejordan 60. The size of the fiefs was variable. The secular fiefs had been set up by conquest and formed solid blocks of land, but the estates of the church and the military orders, which had grown chiefly through charitable gifts and bequests, or in the case of the orders, from strategical convenience, were scattered throughout the Frankish territories. The units in which estates were measured was the village, or kazal, or very rarely a half or a third of a village, but villages also varied in size. Round Safed in northern Galilee, they seem to have averaged only 40 male inhabitants, but we hear of large villages around Nazareth and smaller villages around Tyre, where, however, the general population was larger. Many of the lay lords also owned money fiefs, that is to say, they were granted a fixed money revenue from certain towns and villages, and in return had to provide soldiers in proportionate numbers. These grants were heritable and almost impossible for the king to annul. As with the landed fiefs, he could only hope that the possessor would die without heirs, or at least with only a daughter, for whom he had the right to choose a husband, or to insist on the choice of a husband out of the three candidates that he proposed. The king of Jerusalem was at the apex of the social pyramid, but it was a low apex. As the Lord's anointed, he commanded some prestige. It was high treason to do him an injury. He presided at the high court, and he was commander-in-chief of the forces of the realm. He was responsible for the central administration, and he appointed its officials. As his vassals' ruler, he could prevent them from alienating their lands, and he could choose husbands for their heiresses. Having no superior lord to consider, he could make grants as he pleased from his own domain, though, like his nobles, when they alienated lands, he usually associated his wife and children in the grant, lest there should be some later complaint over the widow's dower or the son's inheritance. But there the royal power ended. The royal revenues were restricted and were reduced by overgenerous gifts. The king was always short of money. He was at the head of the kingdom, but he was under the law of the kingdom, and the law was represented by the High Court. The High Court consisted of the tenants-in-chief of the realm, the lords who owed allegiance direct to the crown. Leading ecclesiastics attended in virtue of their landed holdings, and foreign communities who possessed land in the kingdom, such as the Venetians or Genoese, sent representatives. Distinguished visitors might be invited to be present, though they did not form part of the court and had no vote in it. If the King of Jerusalem had any overlord, it was the Pope. The First Crusade anticipated a theocratic state in Palestine, and had Adhemar of Le Puy lived on, some such organisation might have been evolved. It was probably this idea that kept Godfrey from accepting a royal crown. Adhemar's successor, Daembert, envisaged a state controlled by the Patriarch of Jerusalem. Baldwin I countered by assuming the crown and by making use of Daembert's enemies within the church. It was clear that the papacy would not approve of an overpowerful patriarchate in Jerusalem, which might, from its special position and in its increasing wealth, have set itself up, as Daembert hoped, to be an Oriental equal of Rome. It was thus easy for the king to play off Pope against Patriarch. He was traditionally obliged to pay homage to the Patriarch at his coronation, but he sought confirmation of his title from the papacy. Therefore, the vassaldom was little more than nominal, and no stricter than that claimed by the popes over the Spanish kingdoms. But it was useful to the Kingdom of Jerusalem, for the popes felt themselves responsible for keeping up supplies of men and money for the Holy Land, and for giving diplomatic help whenever it was needed. The papacy could also be used to put a check on the Patriarchate and to exercise some control on the military orders. But on the other hand, the Pope might support the military orders against the king, and he often intervened when the king attempted to put some curb on the Italian merchant cities. But the greatest military power in Outremer was that of the military orders. Since their establishment, they had grown steadily in numbers and in wealth, and by 1187, they were the chief landowners in Outremer. Gifts and purchases continually increased their estates. Many Palestinian nobles joined their ranks, and recruits came in steadily from the west. They answered an emotional need of the time, when there were many men anxious to take up the religious life, but wishful still to be active and to do battle for the faith. And they answered a political need also. There was a perpetual shortage of soldiers in Outremer. The feudal organization depended too much on the accidents of family life in the noble houses to provide a replacement for the men that died in battle or of sickness. Visiting crusaders would fight well for a season or two, but then they returned home. The military orders instead produced a constant supply of devoted professional soldiers who cost the king nothing and who were rich enough besides to build and maintain castles on a scale that few secular lords could undertake. Without their assistance, the Crusader states would have perished far sooner. Of their actual numbers, we have only incidental evidence. The Hospitallers sent 500 knights with a proportionate number of other ranks on the Egyptian campaign of 1158, and the Templar knights taking part in the campaign of 1187 numbered about 300. In each case, these probably represented knights from the Kingdom of Jerusalem alone, and a certain number would have been kept back for garrison duties. Of the two orders, the Hospitallers was probably the larger and the richer, but they were still busily concerned with charitable activities. For example, their hostel in Jerusalem could house 1,000 pilgrims. They also distributed alms daily amongst the poor with a generosity that astounded visitors. Both they and the Templars policed the pilgrim routes, taking particular care of the sacred bathing places in the Jordan. The Templars also distributed alms, but less lavishly than the Hospitallers. Their attention was given more exclusively to military affairs. They were famed for their courage in attack and regarded themselves as being dedicated to offensive warfare. They devoted themselves also to banking and soon made themselves the financial agents for visiting crusaders, and they were later to win unpopularity by their suspicion of strange esoteric rites. But as yet, they were universally esteemed for their bravery and chivalry. The advantages brought by the military orders were balanced by grave disadvantages. The king had no control over them, for their only ruler was the Pope. Lands that were given to them were held in mortmain. No services were due from them. They refused to let their tenants pay the rents due to the church. The knights fought with the king's armies merely as voluntary allies. Occasionally the king or a lord might put a castle under their temporary control, and they were sometimes asked to act as trustees for a minor. In such cases, they were liable for the proper services. The grand masters or their deputies sat in the high court of the kingdom, and their representatives on the high courts of the Prince of Antioch and the Count of Tripoli. But the advice that they gave there was apt to be irresponsible. If they disliked the official policy, they might refuse to cooperate, as when the Templars boycotted the expedition to Egypt in 1158. The perpetual rivalry between the two orders was a constant danger. It was seldom that they could be induced to campaign together. Each order followed its own line in diplomacy, regardless of the official policy of the Kingdom of Jerusalem. We find both orders making their treaties with Muslim rulers, and the story of the negotiations with the Assassins in 1172 shows the Templars' readiness to upset an obviously desirable arrangement in the interest of their financial advantages and their frank disdain of the authority of the royal courts. The Hospitallers were throughout more temperate and unselfish, but even with them, the order took precedence over the kingdom. A similar balance of advantage and disadvantage was shown in the relations between the Frankish states and the Italian and French merchant cities. The Frankish colonists were soldiers, not sailors. Tripoli and Antioch each later developed a small fleet, and the orders built flotillas, but the kingdom itself, with its few good harbours and general shortage of timber, never had an adequate naval establishment. For any expedition that involves sea power, such as the conquest of the coastal towns or the campaigns against Egypt, it was necessary to invoke the help of some maritime power. The two great sea powers of the East were Byzantium and Egypt, but Egypt was always a potential and often a real enemy, and Byzantium was always suspect. The Sicilian fleet could have been useful, but Sicilian policy was untrustworthy. The Italians and southern French were better allies, and their help was was further needed to keep open the sea routes to the west and to transport pilgrims, soldiers and colonists to Outremer. But the merchant cities had to be paid. They demanded trading facilities and rights, their own quarters in the larger towns, and a complete or partial freedom from customs duties, and their colonies had to be given extraterritorial privileges. These concessions were not, on the whole, resented by the Frankish authorities. Any loss in revenue was balanced by the trade that they stimulated, and the royal courts had no wish to have to administer Genoese or Venetian law, especially as cases involving a citizen of the kingdom or a serious crime such as murder were reserved to them. One of the most interesting aspects of Outremer was the increasing friendship between the Franks and the Muslims. This happened because the revenues of the Frankish states came largely from tolls levied on the trade between the Muslim interior and the coast. Muslim merchants must be allowed to come down freely to the seaports and must be treated fairly. Out of their commercial connections, friendship grew. The Order of the Temple, with its great banking activities, was ready to extend its operations to oblige infidel clients and kept officials who could specialize in Muslim affairs. At the same time, the wiser statesmen amongst the Franks saw that their kingdom could only last if the Muslim world were kept disunited, and for this purpose diplomatic missions passed to and fro. Frankish and Muslim lords were often received with honour at courts of the rival faith. Captives or hostages often spent years in the enemy's castles or palaces. Though few Muslims troubled to learn French, many Franks, nobles as well as merchants, spoke Arabic. A few, like Reynald of Sidon, even took an interest in the Arabic literature. In times of war, each side appreciated gestures of gallantry and chivalry. In times of peace, lords from either side of the frontier would join together in hunting expeditions. But this growing friendship between Frank and Muslim was ruined by the arrival of newcomers from the West, who only wished to fight the Muslims. This was particularly true of the Church. Not one of the Latin patriarchs of Jerusalem in the 12th century was born in Palestine, and of the great ecclesiastics, only William, Archbishop of Tyre, to whom the patriarch was refused, was born in the Holy Land. The influence of the Church was seldom in favour of an understanding with the Muslim world. And it was even more disastrous in its relations with the native Christians. The native Christians had great influence on the Muslim courts. Many of the best-known Arabic writers and philosophers and almost all the physicians were in fact Christian, and had the Church behaved in a different way, these could have formed a bridge between the Eastern and the Western worlds. Indeed, to the contemporary Western pilgrim, Outremer was shocking because of its luxury and license. However, to the modern historian, it is rather the intolerance and dishonourable barbarity of the Crusaders that is to be regretted. Yet both aspects can be explained by the atmosphere of the time. Life amongst the Frankish colonists was uneasy and precarious. They were in a land where intrigue and murder flourished and enemies lay in wait across the nearby frontiers. No one knew when he might receive a knife thrust from a devotee of the Arab assassins, or poison from one of his servants. Mysterious diseases of which the Franks knew little were rife. Even with the help of local doctors, no Frank lived for long in the East. Women were more fortunate than men. They avoided the risks of battle, and owing to better medical knowledge, childbirth was in fact less dangerous there than in the West. But infant mortality was high, especially among the boys. Fief after fief fell into the hands of an heiress, whose inheritance might lure gallant adventurers from the West, but too often great estates lacked a lord at the hour of crisis, and every marriage was a matter of dispute and of plotting. Marriages were often sterile. Many of the toughest warriors failed to father a child. Intermarriage between the few noble families increased personal rivalries. Fiefs were joined and divided with little regard to geographical convenience. There were perpetual quarrels between the next of kin. So, in conclusion, the social structure that the Franks brought from the West demanded a steady hereditary succession and a maintenance of manpower. The physical decline of the human element was full of danger. Fear made them brutal and treacherous, and uncertainty encouraged their love of frivolity. As their tenure weakened, their feats and tournaments grew more lavish. Visitors and natives alike were horrified by the extravagance and the immorality that they saw all around them. But a wise visitor would understand that beneath the splendid surface all was not well. The king, for all his silk and gold, often lacked the money to pay his soldiers. The proud Templar knight, counting his money bags, might at any moment be summoned to battles far more cruel than those that the West had known. Revelers like the wedding guests at Carrack in 1183 might rise from their tables to hear the mangonels of the infidel pounding against the castle walls. The gallant trappings of life in Outremer hung thinly over anxiety, uncertainty, and fear, and an onlooker might well wonder whether the Crusaders could survive for long. And that's the end of this episode. Hope you enjoyed it. As always, I'd be hugely grateful if you posted any ratings. Thank you so much. And in the next episode, we'll get back to the story of the Crusades and how the Crusaders' fortunes went from bad to worse in the 1150s and 60s as the power of Islam grew and their relations with Byzantium collapsed.